We're doing humility and prophecy, part 7, the man of sin. I apologize in advance for the complexity of this. I don't like complexity, but it's a complex subject and a lot of scriptures. So if you're interested in following through on this, you might want to write down the scriptures. Or if we make copies of these discourses, get a copy to study it out for yourself. The sole point of these studies is to suggest we pump the brakes on the certainty we have regarding prophetic matters, particularly time prophecies, that can lead to ill feelings toward those who don't agree with us. Paul said clearly in 1 Corinthians 13:9, Phillips, our prophecy is always incomplete. Just recognizing that should lead to a view of generosity toward all as regards prophetic matters. Now, I'm stressing this, you may have noticed, discourse after discourse, because I have a concern that I get from what I hear sometime in talks, and what I read in magazines, and that is the dogmatism, the absolute certainty with which some things are presented that really are at best speculative. And they can lead to judgments upon one another that are not healthy. And I'll give you an example. I appreciated our convention enormously and all the speakers. And I'm well aware that we have a diversity of thought among our speakers. I appreciate that. I have no problem whatsoever hearing thoughts different from my own. However, it was presented in one of the discourses that if you don't believe and in fact preach that we are in the Jubilee right now, you're not a member of the church. Brethren, that is taking things a step too far, because the Bible clearly says we all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. We do not stand before the judgment seat of our brethren, of elders, groups, organizations. It's our relationship with the Lord that determines the outcome of our Christian walk. So those kind of thoughts concern me, and I'm trying to discourage them. I have no problem whatsoever with believing that we're in the Jubilee. No problem whatsoever. I have a problem that becomes a determination as to whether or not this person or that person is in the church. Now I'll go, how do we get there? How do we get to that point of such dogmatism? And I think it has something to do with the way we make up certain things and that aren't in the Bible. For instance, there's the idea, and it's okay, that there are 7 stages to the church. But the Bible does not say that. That's our own interpretation of something. There are, in Revelation, 7 churches addressed by Jesus. However, if you study just a little bit of church history, you will learn that everything said of those churches were true at that particular time that Revelation was written. So you can, if you want to, say, well, it also represents stages. But again, that's not biblical. You can't prove it. And then we go a step further, which is where the trouble lies. We say that the angels to those churches are really human messengers. Now, if you study the word angel in the New Testament, there are only one or two times where that word applies to a human being, messenger. The vast, overwhelming majority of the use of that word has to do with spirit beings. So, again, we take that and we say, well, it's not an angel, it's a human being. And then we go yet a step further and we define who those human beings are, placing them at various spots during the age. And guess what? The last one we make our leader, the one we appreciate. Well, that's nice, but brethren, there's no scriptural authority for that whatsoever. In the New Testament, and in fact in the whole Bible, there is a presentation of an individual, the Messiah. He is, throughout the Old Testament, in types, shadows, and prophecies. Then you get to the New Testament, and there is effort after effort made to identify clearly who that Messiah is. And it is Jesus Christ. Crystal clear, said over and over again. There is nothing in the scriptures whatsoever that identify this or that angel or messenger as this or that individual. It's not there. We make that up ourselves. And again, if we wish to do that, that's our privilege. But we must never confuse what we make up ourselves with divine authority or impose upon others that they must in fact believe what we have made up. But if you make up that this or that individual is indeed the last and final messenger from God or Jesus, well then it's not hard to draw the conclusion, well, pretty much whatever they said has to be true. And there that's where we get the dogmatism about prophecy, which I'm trying to discourage so that we can be humble and most of all respectful of one another's views. Now, getting to the subject at hand, there are a number of ideas among us as regards how this age is going to end. Now today, we hope to present scriptures that suggest some other possibilities than what we may be used to. And that view is, in a nutshell, that before the kingdom is established in the person of the completed church and the resurrected ancient worthies, several things must happen. Number one, the entire world will go very dark, dominated by evil and satanic forces. Two, these forces will be targeting two groups, Christianity and Israel. Three, they will succeed in eliminating the true church from the earth and defeating Israel and once again taking most of them out of their land. Now, we're going to start by tracing this final power and try to identify him prophetically. Now, we have a direct statement in Daniel's prophecy that does not lend itself to any but one interpretation. Now, this is in chapter 7, where Daniel had a troubling dream and asked an angel to interpret it. The dream is in verse 2 through 14. The interpretation in verses 16 through 27. In the dream, we are introduced to a character called a little horn. Verse 8. He is characterized in several ways. If we note everything said about this little horn and compare it to where those things are said about other figures in prophecy, we may be able to get a sense of who this is. In verse 8, he is said to have, quote, a mouth speaking great things. Verse 11 says, the great words which the horn spake. Verse 12, a mouth that spake very great things. Verse 25, and he shall speak great words against the Most High. So let's sum this much up. This is someone with great animus toward God who fearlessly expresses that. He's got a big mouth, as the saying goes. Now, there's something else that distinguishes him. Verses 21 and 22. This is a powerful text. The same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. And the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Now that's the verse that allows just one interpretation. Not only does this individual rail against God, but he also goes out to destroy those who worship God, and he succeeds at this until the time the saints possess the kingdom, stated clearly in Daniel. This tells us this is a very end of the age figure, and that his war against the saints is what completes the church on God's timetable, not ours. So, there's a beginning of establishing a persecution of the church at the end of the age, and that is the device used to complete the church at a specific time. Now, in chapter 8, Daniel has another vision. It is detailed in verses 3 to 12. And in that vision, the little horn makes a return appearance. Verse 9, and out of one of them came forth a little horn. Now, the interpretation of all this is in verses 19 to 26. This is what I mean by complexity and how these things have to be studied at home pretty much. Here is the description of the doings of this little horn. This is verses 11 and 12 NIV as regards the little horn. It, that is the horn, set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. Now let's say the prince of the host is Jesus. He's setting himself up to take Jesus' place. It took away the daily sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was brought low. Because of rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. In other words, this is the agency that does away with the daily sacrifice, a theme throughout Daniel. This is also the agency that it has given over to it, the host of the saints. This is the agency that crushes the sanctuary. Now, there's a summation of the little horn's actions in Daniel 8:13. Comes in the form of a question. How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? There's a restating of both an attack upon the sanctuary and the saints. Now here's what is very interesting about chapter 8. In this vision, there was a ram with two horns. That's verses 3 and 4. And there was a goat that defeated this ram. That's verses 5 to 8. In the interpretation, we are told that Babylon was left out of this vision, which began with the ram. In verse 20, This ram is identified as Media and Persia. In verse 21, the goat is identified as the king of Greece. In verse 22, the interpretation says that after that king, which we know as Alexander, passes off the scene, he is replaced by four rulers, and that kingdom divided into four sections. This is all, I think, outlined well in volume 3. Continuing, that all proved historically accurate. Now, the mistake is to think verse 23 follows sequentially in time and describes the Roman Empire. Not only does the interpretation not identify Rome as the next power, as it did the previous powers, Media, Persia, and Greece, but we know from Daniel 7 it is not sequential in time. How do we know that? Because in Daniel 7, 21 and 22, this same horn power is said specifically to make war with the saints and prevail against them until the time comes the saints possess the kingdom. So there's a large gap in time between the ram, the goat, and the little horn. Now there are hints of this in chapter 8. After Daniel 8:22 says Alexander's kingdom is broken up into four divisions, verse 23 says, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressions are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance shall stand up. That's the interpretation of who the little horn is in verse 9, who becomes great, cast down the saints, takes away the daily sacrifice, and cast down the sanctuary. We've seen from other scriptures that happens at the very end of the age. Now, verse 26, NIV, sums up the timing of the vision this way. Seal up the vision, for it concerns the distant future. Now, going back to Daniel 7, which is a picture of four beasts, and not three, as in the case of Daniel 8, we find a very interesting statement. Babylon is mentioned in verse 4, Medo-Persia in verse 5, Greece in verse 6, and the little horned beast from verse 7 till the end of the chapter, 21 verses later. Little horn must be pretty important. More prophecies in Daniel are spent on him than anything else. In verse 11 of chapter 7, we read of the complete destruction of this little horned beast. Let's read it. I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. But in contrast to this utter and complete destruction of the horned beast, look what verse 12 says about the other kingdoms that preceded him, Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. So, in a limited sense, although losing their world dominion, these three kingdoms continued to live. And historically, I think we can say that's true to this day. That's true of Rome also, although Rome is not a part of the prophecy. Now, taking this principle over to chapter 8, we read this about the breakup of Alexander's empire into four divisions. Now, see, we're going back and forth between chapters 7 and 8 because they both deal extensively with that little horn, the final destructive power to dominate earth. Now, this is Daniel 8:8. Therefore, the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And that we know, that's Alexander, died at a very young age. And from it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now notice here that a horn is identified as an individual, a king, and it was Alexander. So there's the division of Alexander's empire into four different land areas. Now, to verse 9. Here is the crucial text. It's just mentioned the death of Alexander, the division of the kingdom into four separate land areas. Now, verse 9, continuing the prophecy. And by the way, this is written before any of this ever happened. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great. Now, what does this tell us? It tells us the national origin of the little horn individual. He will be coming from one of the four areas that Alexander's kingdom was divided up into. In simple words, he's Middle Eastern, which would explain his animus toward Christianity and Israel. Now, let's get back to looking at more characteristics of this prophetic ruler. Daniel 8:24 says this about him. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. Now, we can go into the New Testament to find a figure that is empowered by another power. We go to Revelation 13. A beast is described there in great detail. In 13:5, here is what it says characterizes this beast. And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things. There's the big mouth. And blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Now here we have the New Testament describing a beast with the exact same characteristics we've read in Daniel that describe the little horn beast. So we conclude they are the same. They both speak great things. They both reign for 1260 days. They both blaspheme God. Now, much is said in Daniel about this horn casting down the sanctuary. In Revelation 13:6, that is said to be the tabernacle. Quote, and he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And in the next verse, an additional characteristic of this Revelation 13 beast. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Daniel 7:21, the little horn, the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. If Revelation isn't quoting Daniel, it comes as close as it can to quoting Daniel. The scriptures seem to be establishing two things. One, a power at the very end of the age that becomes like the other powers represented in Daniel's image, a dominant empire or force. Two, an end of the age persecution of the saints. Now, getting back to the characteristic of this horn, which is found in Daniel, it becomes powerful, but not by its own power. Of the beast, we read in Revelation 13:2, and the dragon gave him his power. and seat and great authority. Revelation 12, 9 and 22 identify the dragon as Satan. So Satan is behind this horned beast. Now, where else in the New Testament do we read about an individual empowered by Satan? 2 Thessalonians 2:9, today's English. The wicked one will come with the power of Satan and perform all kinds of miracles and fake signs and wonders. Living Bible puts it this way. This man of sin will come as Satan's tool, full of satanic power, and will trick everyone with strange demonstrations, and will do great miracles. Now, if the dramatics at the end of this age begin to sound a little bit like the events that surrounded the Exodus of Israel, you'd be right. Brother Jim went into that last week. It's probably not an accident that in Revelation, it forecasts seven last plagues heading up to the kingdom, a parallel to what was used to free Israel from Egypt. Now, we're probably all aware that Protestantism invented the idea that the man of sin is the Catholic Church, their rival. And we adopted that interpretation. It wasn't ours. We took it upon ourselves. We will suggest there is a serious problem with this view. Several, in fact. First of all, Paul said in 2 Thessalonians, the deception by this man is caused by signs and wonders and miracles. In Revelation 13, there is a power that amalgamates itself with the horned beast. In verse 12, it says, he causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast. Now, how does this happen? Verses 13 and 14, and he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by means of those miracles which he had power to do. That's exactly what Paul described. 2 Thessalonians 2, 9 and 10 RSV. The coming of the lawless one by the activity of Satan will be with all power and with pretended signs and wonders and with all wicked deception. Now, do we recall who else prophesied just such an event? Matthew 24, 24. There shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, inasmuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. There we have clearly stated such great deception, so great that were the elect not protected by God, they too could be deceived. But as Paul says, all others are deceived. And Revelation says the same thing, Revelation 13, 14. And deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by means of those miracles. Now, the Catholic system certainly deceived many, but not by doing miracles. Not only that, but we know Revelation 13 is a very end of the age prophecy, as it identifies this beast as reigning for 42 months, which we've seen in Daniel, is the time of the final destruction of the church before they possess the kingdom. Daniel 7, 21-22. But there is further reason not to believe the Catholic Church is the man of sin. We've got to go to Daniel 11 now. Up until verse 20, many rulers are prophesied in sequence. And they're pretty much, I would imagine, accurately outlined again in volume 3, up till verse 20. In verse 21, a ruler is introduced who's called, quote, a vile person. He is discussed to the end of the chapter and on into chapter 12, which shouldn't be a break because it's continuing the same prophecy that started in Daniel 11:1. Now let's look at some of the things attributed to this vile person and his forces. The key verse is verse 31. And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. Now we know from other scriptures, it is the horned beast that does those things. At the start of the last half of Daniel's 70th week, 1260 days. And here's what verse 36 says of him. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods. Now, the translator Rotherham is very good at recognizing New Testament texts that are quotations from the Old Testament, and it is a wonderful Bible help because he marks clearly anywhere in the New Testament where it's really quoting from the Old, and then he gives a citation. Well, he cites Daniel 11:36 as the source from which Paul is quoting in 2 Thessalonians 2:4, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he's God. So the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians is thus identified as the vile person of Daniel 11, who is the little horn of Daniel 7 and 8, and the beast of Revelation 13, amalgamated with the one called the false prophet later in Revelation. Now what we're doing here, brethren, is a topical study. We're gathering all the scriptures together on the same subject and coming to the best tentative conclusion we can, keeping in mind, as Paul says, our prophecy is always incomplete. Now, we know Jesus quoted from Daniel when he said, watch for the abomination of desolation, because he said what he was predicted was spoken of by Daniel. Now, notice in Matthew 24 the sequence of events he mentions. Matthew 24:15. When ye shall see the abomination of desolation. Okay? Then what? Verse 16. Let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Why? Verse 21. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. That's the sequence in the prophecy of Daniel 11 and 12. Daniel 11:31, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. Daniel 12:1, and at that time there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. Now Jesus said, these days would be cut short. making sure all flesh isn't destroyed for the sake of the elect. Matthew 24:22. For the elect's sake, these days shall be shortened. The reinterpretation of this by some brethren as those days shortened by the elect is a false translation. I've never seen a legitimate translation anywhere that says such a thing. But you can go to Mark's gospel, and he makes it very clear what Jesus is saying and who is credited with stopping those days. Mark 13:20. And except the Lord had shortened those days, no flesh should be saved. But for the elect's sake, whom he hath chosen, he hath shortened the days. The elect do not shorten the days. God does. The elect are the beneficiaries of the shortened days. Now, what is this saying? A time will come, centered in Israel, when the potential for worldwide destruction is reached. God overrules so that what could happen does not happen. And he does that to preserve the lives of his church on earth at that time. Now, Daniel would seem to make the same connection. Notice what he says happens at the time of trouble. Daniel 12:1. There shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time, thy people shall be delivered, everyone that shall be found written in the book. Written in the book. Well-known phrase in the Bible about the church. Exactly what Jesus described in his prophecy. An abomination followed by trouble centered in Israel, the potential for mass destruction. It is abbreviated in order to deliver the lives of the elect living at that time. Now, you know, I personally have never understood the view that we've been in the time of trouble since 1874, or as others say, 1914. Jesus defines the time of trouble as a time when all flesh is threatened, followed by a cessation of trouble which keeps that from happening. Brethren, there has not been, nor is there now, a trouble so extreme that all flesh could be on the brink of destruction unless God intervenes. The next most interesting thing about Jesus' prophecy is what he said to beware of after the time of trouble is stopped. Matthew 24:24. There shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect, showing the elect are still here at that time. The display of signs and wonders, which we've read about in both Daniel, Revelation, 2 Thessalonians, comes after the setting up of the abomination. And it comes after the time of trouble is stopped. The destruction upon Jerusalem comes at the midpoint of the last of Daniel's 70 weeks, Daniel 9:26. The people of the ruler will come, will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, this is what happens after the abomination is seen, Daniel 9:27. In the middle of the seven, he'll put an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation. Daniel is saying clearly it is in the middle of that last week that that abomination is set up. Now, what's it tell us? It forecasts an end of the age, destruction of Jerusalem, and a desolation of some sort of temple. And this marks the time when 1260 days are left in that last week. Now, we've seen in Revelation, this is the period of the destruction of the saints and the time of signs and wonders. Revelation 13:5, power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Verse 7, it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Verse 13, and he doeth great wonders. Verse 14, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by means of those miracles which he has power to do. At this time, the 42 months, the church have been preserved from destruction by the ending of the time of trouble, but they have only been preserved to face their greatest test, the deceptions and persecutions of the beast of the 42 months and his amalgamation with the false prophet. Revelation 13:15, caused that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Jesus alludes to this in Luke 17:30-33. In the day when the Son of Man is revealed, in that day he which shall be upon the housetop and his stuff in the house, let him not come down to take it away. Just stopping for a moment. What's this just telling us? Don't worry about preserving your stuff. What's it say in Revelation 13 regarding this time of darkness and persecution upon the earth against those who would not bow down to the beast? Revelation 13:17. And no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark of the beast. See, there comes a time when there's no way to make a living without acceding to the authority of this God pretender beast. Luke 17:32-33. Remember Lot's wife. Whosoever shall seek to save his life shall lose it, and whosoever shall lose his life shall preserve it. That's the decision that will face Christians at that time. Jesus forecast this as one of the events leading up to the end of the age. This is Matthew 24:9. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Now, to sum up, these scriptures seem to establish three things. A mighty power at the end of the age who hates Christians and Jews and aspires to be worshipped in place of God and Jesus. A time of great persecution of the church, which lasts 42 months and ends their course on earth. An attack upon Jerusalem, which is successful, and a desecration of some sort of the sanctuary or temple before the time when God fights for Israel and restores them for the final time. Our prophecy is always incomplete, but time will tell. If this does nothing more than inspire a greater looking into these prophecies with an open mind, then this effort will be worthwhile. But hopefully, more so than anything, it will inspire humility as regards our prophetic pronouncements, and that we allow great latitude among our brethren for their thoughts on these particular issues, because, as Paul says, our prophecy is always incomplete. Thank you for listening, brethren, and may the Lord add his blessing and overrule those things which are amiss.